Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. You have me, and obviously you've got my better half, and my better half is going to tell you who we've got on.
I am your better half. I don't know what qualifies me, but I'm taking that crown. We're going to the other side of the Atlantic today. I'm quite excited about this because it's something I know nothing about. We have Robin Bernstein with us today. She's a professor of American history at Harvard and a cultural historian who specializes in US racial formation from the 19th century right up to the present day. She's here to talk to us about her new book, which is Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit. Robin, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you for joining us. I think, first of all, let's set the scene for everybody listening. When are we in history? And what does the prison system look like? I'm guessing it looks and conditions and things and the way people are treated is very different to now.
Yeah, where we are, we are in New York State, in the northeast of the United States, and we are in the early 1800s. So up until the early 1800s, prisons were relatively new. Prisons were a relatively new thing globally. And up until that point, prisons had the idea that they should either punish people, their purpose was to punish, or their purpose was to basically confine people, to keep people off the streets. And by punishing and confining people, there was the goal of deterring future crime. So that was the existing idea about what prisons were and what they should do.
So they got no semblance at this point of rehabilitation and helping people.
Yeah, that had just begun. So that was the older version of prisons was the purpose was simply to punish and deter and to confine. And then a new idea came in that prisons should rehabilitate, that prisons should convert people to Christianity, should bring people to God, bring people to repentance. That's where we get the idea of the word penitentiary, that it would produce penitence. But then, and this is what my book is about, then in New York, a completely new idea came around. And this new idea was that, you know, to heck with redemption, to heck with punishment for its own sake, to heck with preventing future crime. None of that really mattered anywhere near as much as profit.
So basically, human beings came up with a really nice thing and it lasted 5 minutes before someone realized they could make cold hard cash out of it.
Basically, that's basically right. I mean, the idea that a prison can rehabilitate people never went away. It still exists. But we know that it has receded because let's think about if somebody wanted to build a prison in your neighborhood and they came into your neighborhood and they said, let's build a prison. This is a really great idea. What would the argument be that they would use? Would they say, this is a great idea because prisons are a way of creating justice and don't you want justice in your neighborhood? No. Would they say, let's create a prison in your neighborhood because it will help people become better people? There's a moral imperative. Don't you want to help people in your community become better people? No, that's not the argument they're going to use. They're going to say, let's build a prison in your neighborhood because it'll create jobs. It'll stimulate the economy. And that's a bizarre idea. That is an absolute bizarre idea that locking people up should be good for the economy and we should support it for that reason. it's become a normal idea, but it's a weird idea. And I want, one of the things I want my book to help happen is for people to really take in how weird that idea is. So I'm showing where the idea came from and who actually came up with this idea and what the effects were and why it was a bad idea from the very beginning. It was a bad idea in the early 1800s and it's a bad idea now.
Right. So let's talk about some of these prisons. So the first one we've got on our list is, if I'm going to pronounce it correctly, is Auburn's Prison. What is so special about this one specifically?
Sure. Auburn's prison was the prison in the United States that came up with the idea that a prison can be a profit-generating enterprise. So Auburn is ground zero. Auburn is the place that that changed the world. They created this prison. I can talk about who created it and why. Well, I mean, the why is very easy. They created it to make money. That was the purpose. They created it to stimulate a local economy and turn a village. Auburn was a tiny little village. They wanted to turn it into a city. And that's exactly what happened. So so this is Auburn. It's in upstate New York. And it created, it's started an idea that changed the world. After Auburn, after the Auburn prison was up and running, it was immediately, almost immediately, imitated throughout the United States and then throughout the world.
Show me the money. That's what people are doing, isn't it?
Oh, that's
so who
right.
is William Freeman? And how does he end up in Auburn prison?
William Freeman was an Afro-Native young man, a teenager in the beginning. He was 15. And he was growing up in Auburn. He was the grandson of the Black founders of the village. So his grandparents, Harry and Kate, had been enslaved and they had been forced to come to the land that would become Auburn and build it up. They had been forced to do that by their enslaver. So he was, so these were very prominent people in the town and their children were very prominent people in the town. And William Freeman was their grandson. So he was African-American. He was also a one quarter Native American and he was very well known in the town because he was part of the most prominent family, the most prominent Black family. And then he, when he was 15, he was accused of stealing a horse. He insisted he did not steal the horse. There was no hard evidence that he stole the horse, but that did not matter. He was sentenced to 5 years hard labor in the Auburn State Prison. And I should explain how Auburn made its money, how it was a profit-driven prison. It was not a private prison. There was no such thing as a private prison. This was a public state prison, but it had factories inside. It was built with factories inside the prison walls. And these factories were used by private companies. So a private company would come in, take the factory, bring in its equipment, and then it would lease the convicts' labor. Usually for 30 cents a day. And the prisoners received no cut of this money at all. So they received no pay, but they were laboring 12 hours a day in factories that were run by private corporations for the profit of these corporations. And what they did in these factories was they manufactured stuff. They manufactured basic consumer goods that were sold throughout the Northeast, especially. So things like carpets and animal harnesses and combs, furniture, shoes, guns, you name it. They built it in this prison. They actually built steam engines for the railroad. So they're manufacturing all of this stuff. So William Freeman is sentenced to 5 years hard labor in these factory prisons. He enters the prison and he is immediately set to work making animal harnesses. He's filing iron. It's very hard work. And he's doing this 12 hours a day for no pay.
He's quite a genteel man as well. And this is like it's a shocking accusation. I mean, some states would just hang you still, wouldn't they, if you stole a horse? Like, definitely, I've seen this on Westerns and things. Like, if you're a horse thief, you're dead because it's someone's livelihood. So, I mean, they've accused him of the social thing of just going, yes, the black man did it. I mean, wow, thank God we don't do that anymore. But
can I throw one thing in before you ask your next question?
Go on then.
Because all that's going through, Alex, I think you're going to know where I'm going to head with this.
And are you going to IKEA?
No.
Oh, I was going to go to the fact that this is their business model now, isn't it?
I'm going a completely different road of this is reminding me of exactly what Hitler's regime did in the concentration camp system, because they did exactly that, where they made use of the labor. The laborees got paid, but they didn't get paid because it actually went into the concentration camp system. And that is literally, I'm going through a testimony right now, and that is red flags are basically screaming at me right now.
We'll get on to the current US penitentiary system and how, oh my God, it's a mess. And I think you're going to tell me it's because of all of this at the beginning. So this poor, quite genteel man, is there any recourse for him? Like, this isn't a horse thief. This is like quite a well-to-do young man that doesn't need to be stealing someone's horse. Did he put up a fight?
Well, he was not a well-to-do man. He was a poor man. And at the point when he was accused, he was not even a man. He was a teenager. He was 15. So no, he was poor. And
comes from a good family.
He comes from a well-known and beloved family. The family was troubled in some ways. His father had died, and his mother was unable to care for him in a lot of important ways. So he did not have an easy life before his incarceration. But I think what I keep coming back to is that he was accused, and there was simply no evidence against him. All there was the word of his accuser. That was it. And he was imprisoned on the basis of that. So I don't know that he didn't do it. He might have done it.
Okay.
I think he didn't do it, but it's possible that he did. But what we know for sure is that he did not have any kind of a fair trial. That we know. So he goes into the prison, and he is absolutely incensed. His grandparents had been enslaved. His father had been enslaved. They had all been freed. His mother had been free from birth. He had been free from birth. But here, his family history's progress toward freedom was suddenly reversed, and he was forced to labor for nothing.
Yeah, God. Mm-hmm. So did he? You said that the trial wasn't fair. Do we know what he said? Do we know how much of a stink he kicked up and how they responded to it? Or was it just like screaming into the void?
Well, we know that he absolutely insisted he did not steal the horse, and he was he never wavered from that. And then later on, he did commit other crimes, and he admitted to them very openly. Much later, he committed other crimes and he admitted them, and he never owned up to stealing the horse, which leads me to believe that he probably did not do it.
So he then ends up being released. How does he find life after being incarcerated? Because I can't imagine being forced into forced labor, literally forced labor, being innocent and then being released from prison.
Sure. Well, he's in prison for 4 years, 5 years. He gets out when he's 20. And we have to realize, since he went in when he was 15, he was in prison for a quarter of his life. So this is an enormous chunk of his life. While he was in prison, not only was he forced to labor, he also was the subject of enormous violence. Because the prison was a very violent place, but also because he resisted from the day he got in. He was always insisting that he did not steal the horse and that he did not want to work for no pay, that he did not think that was fair. And basically what he was saying from the beginning was, don't enslave me. Don't treat me like a slave. That did not work well for him. He was beaten horribly. And at one point he was beaten so badly that he sustained a brain injury. His skull was damaged, and he also lost his hearing as a result of this particular beating. So when he got out of prison, he was deaf. He had been imprisoned for a quarter of his life. He was brain injured. And he was furious that he had been cheated of his wages, as he saw it. So the first thing he does when he gets out of prison is he tries to recover what he sees as back pay. He goes to various magistrates and he asks for their help in recovering back pay, but he is dismissed and laughed at. And that did not go over well.
I love that he's asking, though. I love that he's asking the question, like, I have been wronged and you owe me money, like you say. I mean, so God love him. His options can't have been great. What does he have waiting for him on the outside? Yeah. Beyond trying to get his money back. How does he do?
Yeah. You know, he has people who love him on the outside. He has family. Mm. He has friends. But when he gets out of prison, the whole world has changed. Auburn has changed. Auburn is in the process of becoming a city. The village that he knew is gone. And he's different. He's deaf. He's brain injured. And he is alienated from his family. His family, it's not so easy to just go back to the way things were. He's also older. Everything has changed. But yeah, I think you've made it a really great point, Alex, which is that William Freeman was brave. And he had this amazing faith still in the system that had hurt him so badly. And yet he wants to recover his money legally. And he goes through a legal process to try to get justice. It's quite amazing that he had any faith in justice at all, that he tried first to go through legal channels.
Yeah, I think inarguably, what else can he do? But you're right. They have turned out a potentially innocent person, or definitely a non-violent person. They have subjected him to years of violence and abuse and forced labor. They've made a very damaged physically and mentally angry young man and turned him loose on the street. And I guess he deserves a book about him, because he doesn't do what 99.9% of those angry young men would have done and arguably still do, which is go out and cause more trouble.
Well, I do think William Freeman deserves a book about him, and that's why I wrote a book about him, Freeman's Challenge.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he does deserve a book about him. But then we should be clear that he does commit a terrible violence. And the title of the book is Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit. And one thing that I make very clear in the very first pages of the book is that William Freeman does commit a murder.
It's a shocking inevitability to it that just makes me angry, because he wasn't a murderer until they made him one.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. He showed no signs of becoming the kind of person who would commit murder. He had no motive to commit murder until he was imprisoned.
I love the story, but I'm starting to hate it and hate it even more, because we're going down a very dark road. So what actually then happens at the Van Nest house? Please tell me. Yeah, I don't think I want to know.
There's no happy ending coming, Alina.
Yeah, I'm going to live in my little fairy tale land for two more seconds before you ruin it all for me.
Well, I'm not going to go into some of the horrible details. The book does say exactly what happens in the Van Nest house. So at this point, Freeman has been out of prison for 6 months. He has been trying very consistently to recover his back pay through legal means and also through moral persuasion. He's going all over the city telling everybody who will listen to him that he is owed money, that he deserves money, and that the state owes him money. And he's just laughed at and dismissed. And finally, what he resorts to is what we would call terrorism. He commits a terrible murder. And what is especially terrifying about it is not just that it's a murder, not just that it's a violent act, but that he kills people who never did him any specific harm. He kills people who had no connection to the prison, who had no connection to his incarceration. And he never even claims that they had any connection to the prison or to his incarceration. He never claims that they did him any harm.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So this is really terrifying because it doesn't quote unquote make sense. If he had killed people who had directly hurt him in prison, so it was guards who beat him terribly, let's say he had found that guard and killed that guard. On the one hand, that would have been a sensationalistic murder and it would have been a violent act, but it wouldn't have been frightening to the general populace. Any person could say, well, you know, of course he killed that guard because the guard hurt him. That has nothing to do with me. I'm not implicated. I have no reason to fear. And that would have been a very easy story and it would not have shaken the prison. But instead, what he did was he killed people who had no connection to the prison, but who were just part of the general community, the white community that was prospering through the prison. So even though they weren't specifically connected to the prison, the entire city was prospering as a result of the prison. So let's say you sold hats, you know, you're a hatter, and you don't directly have any connection to the prison, but the city is growing because of the prison and the increasing population is buying your hats. So you're connected to the prison, even if you aren't working with the prison directly. And the family was, this was a white family that was prosperous, and they were just part of the general prosperity that was connected and grounded in this prison. So that is really terrifying. When Freeman kills this family, every single family of all races in the Auburn area and also all of New York has to say, why did he kill them and not me? Why was it the Van Nest family and not my family? And this is the question that terrorism by definition raises. This is why terrorism is so terrifying, because there is no answer for that question. So meanwhile, Freeman was saying absolutely clearly why he killed the Van Nest family. He was perfectly clear. What he said was that he had labored in the Auburn State Prison for 5 years for nothing. That was his phrase, for nothing. And somebody had to pay him. And if he could not get back pay, he was going to get payback against the state. And he actually named it, that the state was his real target. So this was a terrifying answer that nobody wanted to hear, because remember, the Auburn State Prison is contributing to the general prosperity. So nobody, mainly white people, but also African Americans, nobody wants to hear this challenge to the Auburn State Prison. So they have to shut him up. And they found ways to do it.
The second you bring money into it, you lose the ability to make right decisions, I think.
Yeah. There was no room for any kind of soul searching. There was no moment when anybody said, maybe he has a point. Maybe this prison is a cancer at the heart of our community. Maybe we should rethink this. Nobody wanted to go in that direction because it was benefiting them economically.
So he is a guilty man now.
At this point, he admits it. He's caught. He admits it. At this point, he is a murderer.
So he's going back to court. The trial this time. He is. It doesn't matter what he's done. He's still entitled to a fair trial. Does he get one?
Well,
that's a no, isn't it?
Well, he gets a sensational trial. So remember, nobody wants to hear what he is saying about his critique of the Auburn State Prison. Nobody wants to hear his challenge to prison for profit. So they have to shut him up. So they come up with other stories to explain, quote unquote, the murder, because from their perspective, his explanation doesn't make sense because they can't hear it. They don't want to hear it. So they have to come up and they're in this agitated state of terror. So they have to come up with another way to understand the murders. And, you know, I don't want to give everything away because I wrote the book in such a way that I wanted it to be very engaging. I wanted people to be unable to put the book down. And there are a lot of twists and turns and surprises in the book. But what I will say is that the trial becomes national news very quickly because the person who volunteers to represent William Freeman free of charge is William Henry Seward, who was the past governor of New York State. So the past governor steps in to defend him. Meanwhile, the prosecutor is the son of a recent president, U.S. president. So these are very prominent people fighting about William Freeman. And neither side wants to actually hear what he has to say because both sides, the prosecution and the defense, are both invested in the Auburn State Prison. They're both, in their own way, defending the Auburn State Prison. That's what really gets defended in this trial. William Freeman is on trial, but what should be on trial is the Auburn State Prison. And both the prosecutor and the defense lawyer conspire. They informally conspire. They don't like whisper behind closed doors, but both of them managed to make the trial not about the Auburn State Prison, despite everything William Freeman has been saying all along. What they make it about is race. So they don't want to hear this Afro-Native man's challenge to the Auburn State Prison. So what they do instead, both the prosecution and the defense, is they claim that the murder was all about race.
This is, do you know what? It just reminds me of the response to literally now to every high school shooting. It's not about the high school shooting. It becomes about the amendment and the right to bear arms. And it's just... It's hard not to get angry, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm interested in how the state actually reacts to all of these events. Is it a positive or more of a negative reaction?
Well, to the murders, I mean, it's very negative, of course. So the state is very invested also in the Auburn State Prison. And meanwhile, while all of this is happening, the state is creating other prisons built on the Auburn model. So the Auburn system of prison for profit combined with certain other features of its carceral system are being replicated throughout the country and especially throughout New York State. So the state is also very invested in squelching any challenge to the prison. One of the ways that the prison is really important to state politics is that the state parties, which were at the time the Democrats and the Whigs, were fighting about state politics through the prison. So basically, the prison leadership was chosen by whichever party was in power in New York State. So the Whigs would get elected and they would fire all the Democrats. And then the Democrats would get elected and they would fire all the Whigs. So the Auburn State Prison was actually a very important pain point for elections. Very often, if there was a scandal going on at the Auburn State Prison, which there always was because it was a very corrupt place, if there was a scandal going on and that coincided with a statewide election for governor, for example, that would damage whichever party was in control. So if there was a scandal during a Whig administration, it would hurt the Whigs. If there was a scandal during the Democratic during a Democratic administration, it would hurt the Democrats. So there was a lot of entanglement between the prison and state politics. So this was yet another reason why the state had a very strong incentive to shut William Freeman up. And he wouldn't shut up.
No, I'm glad he wouldn't shut up. I hope he went down screaming. Well, I don't want to tell people what happened to him. I'm going to ask you about him in a second. But before we do, because I want to end on him, before we do, it's just, oh, it's money is so insidious, isn't it? So you have something that everyone knows is bad and you don't want it to happen. But now there are stakeholders in positions of authority who are getting rich off of it. You've got zero chance of getting rid of it. What's the legacy of Auburn Prison on the American prison system today, which, as I understand it, I'm not an expert, but I do listen to someone who's very well read on a podcast. It's a shit show, for want of a better description. It's just broken from the top to bottom. I don't know anything about our prison system in Britain to compare it to, so I'm not just bashing America. But as I understand it, I mean, is what's wrong with it today? Can you trace it all back to Auburn?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Auburn is, I would argue that Auburn is the root of many, many ills in the prison system today. One of the really important things that we can take away from my book, one thing that my book really shows, is that the prison system that we have inherited, the prison system that exists today, is based on a set of business ideas that have nothing to do with justice or morality. And they never did. It was all about the money. There were people later who tried to impose morality on the Auburn State system. There were the Auburn State Prison. There were people later on who said, okay, we've inherited this system that has nothing to do with morality and nothing to do with justice. Let's try to make it about morality and justice. And guess what? That doesn't work.
You can't make money out of it because you have to spend more on each prisoner. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, they get paid now, but as I understand it, they get paid absolute nothing on the dollar, and basically the money funds buying ramen noodles and candy while they're in prison.
Yeah, well, about today, about two-thirds of people incarcerated in prisons in the United States have some kind of job. Mm-hmm. And that most of those people are working to maintain the prisons. So most of them are not working for private corporations. There are some people in prisons who work for private corporations, and the pay for that kind of work, the maximum pay nationally is about $1 an hour. So it's very, very low. So we can critique that, and we can critique private prisons. We can critique corporate investment and involvement in prisons. But I actually just want to critique prisons. One of the big takeaways from my book is that prison reform does not work. My book shows a lot of examples where various people with good intentions try to reform the Auburn State Prison, and it is always a total travesty because you can't reform something that at its absolute core is pernicious. You can't take something that was designed to exploit people and somehow turn it into something other than what it is at its absolute core. So I hope that one of the effects of my book will be to make people really question prisons as a whole, whether we actually need prisons. Well, most people today would say, yes, of course we need prisons. But the thing is, when the Auburn State Prison was built, it was built in 1816 and it was fully opened by 1817. By the time it opened, people already thought that it was completely necessary, totally inevitable, that there was no other possibility. This thing had existed for like 10 minutes. Yeah. So when it existed for 10 minutes, people thought that it could never not exist. Well, now we've been saddled with Auburn-style prisons for 200 years, a little more than 200 years, and there are plenty of people who just cannot conceive of a world without prisons. But in fact, the world has existed without prisons, and prisons do not deliver justice. So what justification is there to continue them?
It's an interesting thought. Let's just finish on Freeman. I'm not going to say what happens to him because I want people to buy the book.
Thank you.
Does he do the murders and the outcome of them. How does it affect the wider African-American community at the time? Because doesn't Frederick Douglass get involved?
Yeah, he does. So the murders are terrifying to the white community. They're differently terrifying to the Black community. So the Black community is, first of all, there is white fury, white rage against not just Freeman, but a generalized Black community. And the Black community is terrified of racist retribution, not only against Freeman, but against everybody. So they're put in a terrible position, a really untenable position. Freeman is one of the things that happens in the trial is that Freeman is largely silenced. And what my book is trying to do is reverse the effect of the trial, to unsilence him, to listen to what he actually said, because there is a lot of documentation of what he actually said. So I'm trying to recover that. But in the moment, he was silenced. And what's really amazing is that very shortly after his trial, Auburn becomes a center for Black lecturing and Black abolitionist activity and Black publishing. So Black people start, there was already a Black community in Auburn, but activists, Black activists, start coming to Auburn to give public lectures. And Frederick Douglass is one of those people. Before Freeman's trial, Frederick Douglass never once came to Auburn. And then after the trial, he starts coming every year and giving lectures. And he's not the only one. There are quite a few others who had never come before. But all of a sudden, they want to be telling their own stories in Auburn. They feel drawn to Auburn as a place to speak their own truths. And then Auburn becomes a site for abolitionist publishing. So Frederick Douglass publishes My Bondage and My Freedom. His second book is published simultaneously in Auburn and elsewhere. And there are other books as well that are slave narratives that are published in Auburn in the 1850s, right after the trial. And then Harriet Tubman comes to Auburn. Harriet Tubman comes to Auburn, the great abolitionist Harriet Tubman, known as the Moses of her people, who escaped from enslavement and then helped dozens and dozens of other people escape. She comes to Auburn and she settles there. She buys land. And she buys land from the man who was William Freeman's attorney. And his wife, Harriet Tubman actually buys the land from William Henry Seward's wife, Frances Seward. And she settles there and she lives, Harriet Tubman lives in Auburn for the second half of her life until 1913. So Auburn becomes a site of Black activism and Black truth telling and Black freedom making in the wake of William Freeman's challenge to the Auburn State Prison.
I think that there's some parallels there with what happens in Selma a long time afterwards, isn't there? I remember when we were interviewing Mark Peterson, who grew up there, and he was saying about when he was having a mixed race prom in Selma, Alabama, no one else in the vicinity was. And that was all a legacy of what had happened there as well. And it became like a magnet as well for change.
Yeah, it did become a magnet. I think that's a good way to put it. After William Freeman's challenge, Black people wanted to come to Auburn and tell their own stories, do what William Freeman was prevented from doing.
That was such an interesting story. I now need to know what happens. I have to go out and get a copy of this book, because this is it. You've left us on a cliffhanger, and I really don't like being left on a cliffhanger. So I think everybody who's been listening to this podcast is going to do exactly what I'm doing. And
you
go
can't
and grab
hold it against the academic. They get wider attention so little and often that when they get it, you gotta let them milk it for all it's worth.
That's fine, but I still need to know what happens, because I hate this. So I'm listening to a lot of audiobooks. So hopefully this comes out on audiobook and I can sit and do work and listen and find out what bloody happens at the end. So Robin,
it is coming out in audiobook. Both the book and the audiobook are coming out on the very same day, May 2nd.
Perfect. I'm in and I'm going to grab it. We'll get your book in our bookshop. And I've had a really great time. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.